So the story of the day at Janie's preschool was Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, one Janie had never heard before. It was about, about a beautiful maiden fed a poison apple by an ugly witch and falls in a trance. Is this familiar to you? Doomed to sleep the rest of her life unless she gets kissed by the extraordinarily handsome Prince Charming. And Janie loved the story, couldn't wait to tell Mom all about it. She said, "Mama, want me to tell you the story of Snow White?" And her mama said, "Well, of course." And except in Janie's account, when it came time for Prince Charming to kiss Snow White, Janie said, "Mama, guess what happened then?" Mama said, "Why, they lived happily ever after." Janie said, "No, Mama, they didn't live happily ever after. They got married." How precocious. Living happily ever after and getting married are not necessarily synonymous terms. Sad, but true. But why? How come so many marriages that begin so beautifully often end so tragically? On day one, everything is perfect. Flowers, music, hugs, laughter, words of hope, outsized promises, an idyllic start to a fanciful start of life together. Except before too long, the glory fades into a grind, and those tearful, soft-spoken promises give way to angry accusations and cruel put-downs. Laughter gives way to tears. Ecstasy exits in favor of agony. And the thing is, nobody wants that to happen. I've never had a couple say to me, "Pastor, we want to get married, but we don't want just an average run-of-the-mill marriage. We want to make each other miserable. Can you show us how to live in grinding hostility the rest of our lives?" It never happens. Instead, every couple I've ever married believes that their marriage is going to be different. Different as in decidedly delightful, perfectly pleasant, hilariously happy. But even more, different as in better. Way better, for example, than my grandparents' marriage. Because, see, they were so committed to the institution of marriage, no matter how bad things got, they were committed to the institution, even though the Bible never says be committed to marriage. It says be committed to each other. And what made this so confusing to grandkids is their marriages remained stubbornly intact, even though everybody knew they were grindingly unhappy. Why was that? Because the same stubbornness that kept them together also kept them from fixing what was broken. So they stayed together, but lived almost exclusively apart. But better also than our parents' marriage, who also saw marriage as an institution, as in a prison to be escaped from. Because this marriage ain't cutting it, but maybe it'll be better next time, which was a real problem because most baby boomers were committed more to me than to my marriage. Which brings us to today's generation, because those who marry these days, they want to do better than their forebears. The trouble is, you think you can get there via negotiation. And here's what I mean by that. Pastor, what we're going to do is we're going to leverage the downside of marriage that we've seen in our parents and our grandparents because we're going to cut our deal up front. Kind of like writing an app on your phone. Instead of marriage being about creating a new us, it's all about pleasing me. So we're going to smush marriage down all the way to its first and last letters, revealing a simplified app for how we're going to make marriage work for me. Because let's be real, Pastor, everybody approaches marriage with certain desires, a dream, a wish for what it's going to be like and how our marriage is going to work. So if we can build a plan, Pastor, so that I can get most of what I want and she can get most of what she wants, maybe we can get to better. So, baby, here is your space, and here is mine. Here's your money. here's mine. I want this as part of my schedule, and you can have that as part of your schedule. Basically, if you dot the I of my desires, I'll dot yours. Deal? Deal. And boy, do we have desires. Financial desires, sexual longings, emotional wishes, with the common denominator in all of these desires, that big fat I that's right in the middle of every single one of them. Because here's how I want it, how I picture it, how I envision it to be. And if you can get me there, our marriage will be hilariously happy. But here's the problem with building a marriage app. Because if that's how you plan to make your marriage work, you will never experience the fullness that God has for you. And your story will never read any better than your forebears' story. Because all you're doing is managing expectations and pre-packaging carefully negotiated deliverables. And yet you will still come to the end of your marriage, and unless the two are you, of you are the first two in human history to keep your marital box score perfectly tied so that no one spouse gets a commanding lead on the other spouse, then he will either owe you or you will owe him. Either way, nobody wins. And here's why. When two people walk the aisle, we are fairly confident we've downloaded the right couple. Am I right? So we trade heady promises, a couple of rings, a little bit of spit, and then we walk out, with a truckload of expectations. Because when marriage is all about cutting deals, that's what happens. The desires you dreamed and eagerly aspired to, over time, those desires become demands. Have you noticed? And when desires become demands, that's a zero-sum game. And here's what I mean by that. Over time, you no longer get credit for doing what was once a desire, but now it's an expectation, which is why you no longer get any kudos, even if you're still doing that thing perfectly. Instead, what you do get is hassled for what you did not do. Because if your marriage is just an app, what begins as, wouldn't it be awesome if, typically ends with, why don't you ever do that? And that growing disenchantment becomes a debt-debtor relationship, because you owe me. You promised. You're the wife. Won't you act like one? Or I married a man, not a boy. Man up. But again, unless you keep the score in a perpetual dead heat, or at the very least, neither spouse gets more than one run behind at any given time, you will either owe him or he's going to owe you. And that's a loser's proposition. Now, maybe you're wondering why in the middle of this quaint little letter, I'm suddenly talking about Peter. Here's why. Because Peter, in 1 Peter 3, he's writing to believers who have really been through some stuff. They've been driven by their homes. They're facing horrific persecution, primarily because their culture was increasingly hostile to everything they had believed. And Peter, not one to pull punches, he just outright calls them strangers in the world, scattered, because that's what they were. They were scattered and suffering all kinds of trials. And yet, Peter tells these suffering believers to greatly rejoice and to set their hope on the coming of Jesus. He also encouraged them to not conform to evil, but be holy in all you do, adding this, live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God when he visits us. Therefore, Peter writes, I urge you as aliens and strangers in this world to abstain from sinful desires. And instead of angrily reacting to unfair treatment by the governing authorities who are persecuting you, submit yourselves. Do you remember that from last week? Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every authority instituted among men. And the key word is submit. Why, Peter? For it is God's will. That's why. And then he talks about the workplace. So not slaves like we know slavery, but people who couldn't pay their debts, so they worked for free until the debt was satisfied. But Peter uses the S word again. Slaves, submit to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and considerate, but also to those who are harsh. Why? Because to this you were called, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. Now, ignore the chapter break here, because Peter didn't put it there. Chapters and verses came along much later, just to make it easier for us to find stuff. But the theme is still consistent. It's still submission. It's submit to your government, submit to your bosses, submit as Christ submitted for you. Turn the page, chapter 3, verse 1. Wives, in the same way as who? In the same way as Christ. In the same way as slaves. In the same way as citizens. Just like those, wives, you must also submit. Now, that's the Greek word, hupotassomai, and as we saw last week, it means to fall in rank under the authority of another. Now, you need to know, I'd rather be just about anywhere in the whole world than where I am right now. Because submission has become, hasn't it, dirty, a demeaning, gender-limiting term. To such a degree, even we pastors don't like talking about it, even though the Bible does. But since God called me not to reflect my culture, but to teach Scripture, I got to tell you what I know that means, even though I sure wish this helmet would fit my melon head, because I'd be wearing it right now. Because here's the thing, every culture throughout history, we found a way to interpret male headship in marriage in a way that marginalizes and, worse, oppresses women. And men are just never the first ones to see that as a problem. Which is why male me, standing up here stating that God has established gender roles in marriage, is at best controversial, if not downright combative. And I've watched, as you have, these Bible verses used in many situations as weapons to either advance the oppression of women or their rebellion. But here's the thing. I've also seen healing. And I've seen happiness blossom when these hot-button words like headship and submission are understood correctly, and Jesus is the ultimate example of both. Because I believe with all my heart that in Jesus, all the authoritarianism of authority is laid to rest, and all the humility of submission is glorified. So ladies, please don't throw stuff at me, because I don't make the news, I just report it. But Peter wants you to know, wives, that you really have been called by God to submit to your husbands. And your husband, look at him, as clumsy and clueless as he can be so much of the time, he is nonetheless called by God to function as the head of your family. But not head as in supreme commander. No, in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 25, it says that Jesus was the head of the church, yet he loved his bride so much, he gave up his life for her. Neither do these gender roles mean that your wives are to be a doormat to you as the husband and you are the dictator. It doesn't mean that she is inferior and you are superior. It doesn't mean that you are always right and that you, wife, should never ever confront him or dare disagree with him. No, if you slide down to verse 6 in this same chapter, you will find Sarah endorsed as the wife of record. But I want to remind you, when knucklehead Abraham went and made a baby with Sarah's maid Hagar, Sarah said to him, "The Lord judge between you and me, but you are responsible for the wrong I am suffering." She didn't badger him. She didn't rip him to shreds, but made it abundantly clear, "I'm not putting up with this nonsense." So wives, biblical submission doesn't mean you put your brain in neutral. Doesn't mean you never express your opinion or you quietly absorb whatever abusive harm he wants to deliver. It simply means that you acknowledge God's divine order in creation. And though you are, without question, your husband's spiritual, intellectual, and emotional equal, there is still an order. And the responsibility of headship unquestionably falls to the husband. But don't get all worked up about that, because if you slide down one more verse to verse 7, Peter says, "Husbands, in the same way." Say, what? Bet your hubby's never quoted this verse to you. Yet it's the exact same phrase in verse 1. "Husbands, just as your wives submit to you, just as Jesus submitted to his accusers, just as slaves submit to their masters, just as citizens submit to their governmental leaders, you, in that same way, are to submit to, be considerate of, and willing to yield to your wife." And all God's daughters said, so, here's what we're going to do. Everybody take a deep cleansing breath, all right? Because we're going to look at verses 1 through 6 of chapter 3, where Peter begins by giving wives three bits of counsel. Counsel for wives who are struggling. Why were they struggling? Well, they've been driven from their homes. They're living in a strange land under persecution. And they were also living with husbands who weren't playing fair. The already unbearable problems they were facing were exacerbated, do you see it in verse 1? By men who did not believe the word. In other words, they had little regard for the truth of God. They mocked God. Maybe they just outright ignored God. And so these wives were married to unbelievers. Now, the temptation when you're joined to a mate like that is to pout and sulk and scheme and nag, hoping that either through conviction or shame, or maybe just wearing him down, your spouse is going to get his act together. But Peter says, ladies, it doesn't work that way. God's preferred method for you is to focus on changing you, not him. Listen to this. Wives, in the same way, be submissive to your husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behavior of their wives when they see the purity and reverence of your lives. Now, we try to do it the other way. You know, when he finally starts doing what he's supposed to do, maybe I'll do what I'm supposed to do. But till then, you can shove all this reverence, purity, submissive junk. But Peter says the only way you can ever hope to change that rascal you're married to is to change you first. And don't kid yourself, that appearingly inattentive husband, he really is watching. Do you see that word, see? It means literally to peer intently, not kidding, as at an athletic event. Do I need to tell you how intently your husbands watch athletic events? I mean, just try having a conversation while the Cardinals are playing, okay? Because he's watching every play and replay, backing up the remote, yelling at the TV. He doesn't even know you're in the room unless, of course, you've got snacks. Well, in that same way, your hubby's watching you. But it's what he sees, not what he hears, that grabs his attention. It's not the Bible verses you quote. It's not the post-it notes you put on the bathroom mirror. It's not the elbow jabs you give him in church. It's that day-in, day-out godly behavior of your life. That's what's going to win him over. But Steve, I want him to be won over before it's too late. So tell me, how can I change him? Simple. Change you first. Act the way a godly wife should. Stop nagging, quit belly aching, be done with idle threats and guilt-producing tears. Believe me when I tell you, there is nothing more stubborn in all the world than a husband who feels backed into a corner. In fact, the wisest marital advice I've ever heard came from Ruth Bell Graham. She said about her husband, the Reverend Billy Graham, "It's my job to love and respect Billy. It's God's job to make him good. God called you not to make your husband good, but to make him happy." By contrast, consider Mrs. Moeller. She was standing trial for the murder of her third husband. The prosecuting attorney asked her, "What happened to your first husband?" She said, "He died of mushroom poisoning." "How about your second husband?" the DA asked. "He died of mushroom poisoning too." The lawyer said, "Okay, how about your third husband?" "Oh, he died of a brain concussion." The lawyer said, "How'd that happen?" "He wouldn't eat the mushrooms." Let's move on. Second piece of advice. Wives, pursue inner beauty, not just outer beauty. Because your beauty, Peter says, should not come from outward adornment. Now, speaking for the men in the room, I want to thank the translators who add texture to that phrase, correctly so. For example, the New American Standard says your adornment must not merely be external. Another says, let your beauty not just be outward. J.B. Phillips says your beauty should not be dependent on braided hair, gold jewelry, fine clothes, and the like. The point he's making is don't go overboard. Don't get so caught up dolling up the outside that you let your insides get nasty. I mean, not even Nicki Minaj's makeup kit can cover up a dirty heart. Now, some preachers take this too far. Maybe you've heard them. I have. Have you ever heard a preacher take a riff on this? Women should never braid their hair. Women should never wear jewelry. Women should never wear dresses. No. They never say, because Peter is not encouraging nudity. Okay? And yet, if you take the logic of the right reverend, fire-breathing, legalism, spit and pulpit pounder to his logical conclusion, that's where you end up. But I want you to know, Peter is not bad-mouthing cosmetics or aerobics or wardrobes or hairdos. He's just saying, keep it in balance. But ladies, please hear me. Peter is not saying that there shouldn't be something on the outside worth looking at. I mean, if the barn needs painting, I agree with Chuck Swindoll. He said there's not a man alive who wants to marry a woman that looks like a fundamentalist. I want you to believe all the right stuff, just don't look like it, okay? Which goes for men, too. Come on, guys, take a shower, even on your day off, please. And rein in certain bodily functions. There is not a woman alive that feels special when certain eruptions take place. Do we have to go any further with this? But ladies, Peter is addressing you because men were made by God to respond to what we see. Now, men, don't leave me hanging. When you see a pretty woman, you look. Am I right? Jeez, really? No, they're lying to you. Men respond to visual stimuli, which is why it is so important, wives, for you to look nice and dress well and appear attractive. Am I right, men? Oh, jeez. Woo. Yeah, feed some meat to these men. Having walked, obviously, on a branch all alone, I think I need to also say what Peter is saying here. Wives, don't become so consumed with that, fixing your hair, doing your body, your face, and all that, that you ignore the far more significant aspect of your beauty. He says, instead, your beauty should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. Wow. Peter, guided by God himself, says that a wife's attitude is to be marked by a gentle, quiet spirit. And if she's got those two things, she has a beauty that's just never going to fade. And that's a deal you can't get at Sephora's. If you're a woman of gentleness, if your spirit is calm and peaceable, you will be forever a knockout. And that doesn't mean you have to be a mousy wallflower or some shy, timid, nervous kind of introvert. No, quite the opposite is true. That word gentle really refers to enormous power. It's just that power is under control. And that quiet spirit is an elegant humility. And before you write off Peter, you know, as some kind of antiquated gender bias jerk, just check it out. When Jesus took the time only once in his entire ministry to describe who he was to others, care to guess the two-word description he gave of himself? He said, "Wow, I am gentle and humble in heart." He didn't swoop down from heaven on a tomahawk missile. He was born in a barn. And the ministry he led was not led by violent protest or talk of revolution. No, he healed people and loved people. And when those same people he healed abused, despised, and rejected him, he still responded with a gentle, quiet, humble spirit, because that's who he was. And that's why Jesus is still, all these generations later, the most attractive personality in the world. And wives, that's how you can be attractive to your world, too. I had a man come to me several years ago. I was just a young pastor. He wanted to tell me that he was divorcing his wife, and I was kind of young and stupid, and I said, "Dude, why would you divorce her? She's gorgeous." He said, "If you had to live with her, you'd know why. She is so angry and bitter, judgmental and self-centered. I've learned, Steve, the hard way. After a while, you can't even see the face anymore because all you can see is that ugly heart." Reminds me of King Solomon, who said, "Like a gold ring and a pig's snout is a beautiful woman who shows no discretion." But a wife who's gentle, with a soft, quiet spirit, who refuses to manipulate, pout, talk, and scheme, but instead she trusts the Lord with this beautiful, peaceful spirit, her beauty is just never going to fade. A beauty not just obvious to her husband, but of great worth in God's sight. Here's Peter's third bit of wisdom. Wives, be attentive to your husband. For this is the way the holy women of the past who put their hope in God used to make themselves beautiful. They were submissive to their own husbands, like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him her master. You are her daughters if you do what is right and do not give way to fear. Did you notice that word obeyed? Did you notice that word obeyed? Of course you did. Burning a hole in the screen, even as I speak. Let me just tell you, a better paraphrase of that is this. Sarah was loyal to her husband. She lavished him with attention and care, putting his needs above her own. I love the way the Message puts it. The holy women of old were beautiful before God. They were good, loyal husband wives to their husbands. Sarah, for instance, taking care of Abraham, would address him as, "My dear husband, you'll be true daughters of Sarah if you do the same." That's good stuff, ladies. Could be the most important word of all in this passage, because nothing will cultivate a better relationship with your husband than your loving attentiveness. Now, I get the battle. I mean, especially if you got kids, it's so easy with all the demands and the needs and the never-ending press of careers and meals and laundry and 1,003 other things to push your mate to the back 40. But maybe it's time to make some changes. And you don't got to go to a seminar or get counseling. Just do as Peter says. He's already given you 3 more things than you're currently doing. Just do it. Now, I have a feeling some of you are thinking, "Pastor, if I start making all these changes, what guarantee do I have that he won't take advantage of me? How can I know that once again he won't disappoint me?" And Peter says, you can't know. But see, that's not the point. The point is, you do what is right and don't give way to fear. Another version says, yield to no panic and instead trust God to protect you. Trust God to handle that husband of yours. Stop taking daily reads on whether he's responding to you or not, so that if he isn't, you quickly backtrack because maybe he doesn't mean it anymore. No, you do what is right. Don't give way to fear. Trust God to bring about the changes, because God really can change that dude you married. He really can. Now, if I was the kind of husband to take advantage of a moment like this, I would probably suggest that since Peter uses 6 verses to teach the wives and only 1 verse for the husbands, that must mean that wives need 6 times the help we husbands need. But I'm not going to say that. Here's what I will say. The same thing Peter said. Husbands, in the same way, with the same spirit of submission your wife is to show toward you, you must respond to her in that exact same spirit. Besides, even though we've only got 1 verse, men, there's enough material in that 1 verse to keep you busy for a lifetime. So, are you ready, men? Yes. Taking my breath. Are you ready, man? Yes. All right. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives. So, principle number 1, husbands, live with your wife. Now, some of you wives are thinking, really? That's kind of chintzy. Well, of course he's going to live with me. Pastor, that doesn't sound nearly as intense as the quiet and gentle stuff you just laid on me. But what if I told you that verse has nothing to do with location? Peter's point is not that husbands should share the same address with you. the real meaning is so much deeper. That word live means to dwell together, to be at home with, to share your life with your bride. And it conveys the thought that as you strive to do life together, you do that even though you're very different people. And men, that's your job. And I think Peter makes a point of this because far too many husbands think, you know, I bring home the paycheck. I've done my job. Sorry, guys, not even close. Your wife did not marry a paycheck. She married you. Besides, if you were to die today and she stands by a fresh grave in a week or so, she's not going to be thinking about your pay stub. She's going to be thinking about you. So the question is, men, are you at home with your wife? Do you enjoy a true companionship and an obvious togetherness with your bride? Or are you more comfortable in the workplace or watching a game with your buds? Do you have room in your life for your wife? Far too many husbands are content to provide a living when they ought to be sharing a life. The complaint I hear all the time, even correctly, I might add, from my own wife. My husband won't open up to me. I wish I knew what he was thinking, but he won't let me in. And even when he's at home, it's like he's not even there. A problem that all men seem to have because we cut the marriage deal, right? And so instead of a true marriage, we've got this deconstructed kind of marriage app, and both parties are complicit in the resulting dysfunction. So maybe the husband is the absentee partner, but the wife has freight to pay too. Because part of the reason we settle for this marriage app instead of seeking the real deal is that we're focused more on fitting in and less on belonging. Let me tell you what I mean by that. We try to become what we think our spouse wants us to become, which works for a while, but eventually it'd be nice if I could bring my whole self to this marriage. Do you know what I mean? Listen, your marriage will not survive if only one spouse is trying to do all the fitting in to the expectations of the other. And make no mistake, to belong, it's not the same as fitting in. To belong means I feel accepted as my whole self. No adjustments required, because I want all of you to be a part of this relationship and all of me too. And nobody, including me, is allowed to radically change you. No, you just show up as you are, and then if you do decide to change, it's because you decided to change, not because I forced you to change. Men, Peter is telling you that it's way past time for you to tear up your wife's fitting in contract and to see all those quirky expectations that you've been laying on her for how she's got to fit into your life instead of both of you belonging to each other's life, because all those expectations, they've got to die and get replaced so that true biblical oneness is restored. Keep reading. Peter adds, and treat her with respect. Except the original language literally means live with her according to knowledge. Not the kind of superficial knowledge that means you can pick her out of a crowd or you know her favorite pasta or TV show. It has in mind a deep appreciation for her inmost desires, her unspoken worries, her deepest fears. It's knowing stuff nobody else knows, just you. Her disappointments and expectations, her scars, and also her secrets, her thoughts, as well as her dreams. That's what Peter means. It means, men, that you get her. What makes her tick, and what makes her ticked. that you perceive her need for encouragement before she has to beg for it. You give her a hug because you sense she could use a hug. Something I know it doesn't come naturally for any man. I mean, let's face it, men tend to bond by doing stuff. Am I right? I mean, we don't even talk as we do this stuff, which is why we like golf, fishing, and hunting. Because you're not supposed to talk. And in those rare moments when we do talk, we tend to spar with each other. Right, guys? In fact, the more hostile the put down, the more vicious the cut down, the closer we probably are. But you can forget that, dude. Nuh-uh. I ain't holding your hand, not even in a prayer circle, because that's weird, because my hand gets sweaty, and I'm not comfortable doing that. But see, here's the thing. If she's your wife, hold her hand. Even if you don't like it, you hold her hand in here and in there. You hold her hand anywhere. You'd hold her hand in a box. You'd hold her hand with a fox. Could you, in a car, hold it, there it are. Sorry. The point I'm pathetically trying to make is, men, do not treat your wife like a man. Instead, cultivate a sensitive, understanding spirit so that when you ask her what's wrong and she says, oh, nothing, you realize nothing means something. And if you don't take the time to probe under the surface and figure out what that something is, that something ain't going to go away. It's going to pop up and probably clean your clock. Now, it takes years to cultivate such wisdom, plus lots of mistakes, lots of listening, loads of interaction. And chances are very good, men, your wife is down for it. And some of them will die wishing they had gotten it. Few things will make a wife feel more secure than the emotional intimacy she receives from her willing husband. Now, I said before, much to very lame response, that men respond primarily to what they see, right? But women respond not to visual stimuli. They respond to emotional intimacy. Right, ladies? Women, that's what I'm talking about. Wives love to be the focus of their husband's affection. They love it when you take time to talk with them and ask a question or two about their day. They long for a connection that's deep and strong and true. Do you know your wife's greatest fear? What she's struggling with right now? Do you have a clue what she's worried about more than any other thing? And by the way, some of the best advice I ever got was from a friend years ago who said, Wyatt, the secret to being a good husband is don't attend every argument you're invited to. That's deep. You're not writing that down, guys. Write it down. Isn't it amazing how two people can live together and still not know each other? Peter says, men, that a godly husband will make it his ambition to make that kind of understanding happen. And then finally, Peter says, value your wife as God's precious gift. You see it? Treat her with respect as the weaker partner. Time out. He's not saying that women are weak. If you've ever witnessed childbirth, you know otherwise. But women do tend to be weaker. Physiologically, men on average have greater muscle mass than women. So in a typical tug of war, 10 average men would pretty much destroy 10 average women. That's all he's saying. So back off. The point, though, is this. That term in the Greek actually suggests something of finest quality. It's like the difference between a plastic mug and a porcelain teacup. Compared to that big old ice tea stained mug, that cup is so very delicate. If you drop it, yeah, it will break. But it's the inherent weakness of the cup that makes it of such greater value. And because of that greater value, we plastic mugs, man, ought to highly esteem and deeply respect our gorgeous, precious, and delicate teacups. And that's the point. So men, how do you treat your wife? How do you? And I'm not talking about in the immediate aftermath of this sermon. I get that. But typically, do you take the time to show how much you value her through a note or holding her hand or surprising her with something she didn't expect? Maybe it's nothing more than a sure winner in our home, a Rocky Mountain Chocolate Factory peanut butter bucket apple. Better than flowers. Maybe that's not your strong suit. That just means you need to work on it. So there it is. Plenty of work for both spouses, right? If you're the wife, your attitude, your adornment, your attention, that is what your husband needs from you more than anything else. And if you're the husband, you need to live with your wife and work to understand your wife and to treat her for the delicate gift from God that she is. That's your job. Now, here's the problem. And this is why so many of us not only get stuck, we stay stuck. Here's the problem. You ready? Who goes first? Especially if there's been pain, right? Misunderstanding, disappointment, disrespect. Who goes first? And here's the answer. I got it for you. You ready? You do. You do. You got to be the one to go first. There's a great word in Genesis 4. God confronts Cain, who's livid because of a perceived slight by his little brother Abel. And God says this to Cain. He says, "Cain, if you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at the door. It desires to have you, but you must master it." Same thing is true in your marriage. Your hurt, your frustration, your disappointment, your anger at whatever it is you believe your mate has done, that anger, right now it's crouching at the door and it is seeking to devour you. Wants to pounce on you and destroy not only you, but your mate as well. And so the question is, what's it going to be? Peter says, you be the first. You go first. Whatever she did to you, or whatever you perceive he did to you, let it go. And then go first. Let's pray. Father, this is straight up stuff. And I'm certain in this room there are dozens of minds that are already thinking through, how can I get away from being the one who has to go first? How can I justify the rightness of my position? And Father, I just admit to you that I may be the last person to share this message today. The last one qualified. The last one who really has any insight to share it all. But Lord, this truth comes not from me. It comes from you. And so I pray that was set aside, who goes first and who did what, and she did this and he did that, and instead to say, this is God's plan. I want to live in obedience before Him, and so I'm going to go. And I thank You, Father, before we have the chance to do that, that we have a meal that reminds us, just in the taking of the bread and the cup, that every one of us have been utter failures in our marriage. We have messed up on so many levels. That's why we needed Jesus. I thank You that He came. I thank You that He's our Savior. I thank You that in these moments we can confess to You our deepest need and seek in You, where alone we can find complete forgiveness, freedom, and the chance to start over again. Father, cause that to happen in the lives of several marriages in this place. May our tribe increase as those who are very, very imperfect, but want to keep leaning in. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.